Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. It's Monday, February 20th, and I'm your host, Kara Santa Maria. We have a great episode for you today, but before we dive in, I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week. As you know, because I say it over and over at the beginning of the podcast, I've made it my mission to ensure that Talk Nerdy is and will always remain 100% free to download, which means you can listen to it anytime, anywhere, and you don't have to pay a penny. But the way that I can do that is through generous support from listeners like you, along with the ad sales that I do throughout the podcast. We do have one ad later in the show, but at the top of the show, I love to thank those of you who have made it possible throughout the week. There's a couple different ways that you can, actually, there's more than a couple ways. There's a few ways you can support the show, but you can find all of them by visiting my website, carasantamaria.com. There, you can click through to the most popular form of support, which is my Patreon portal, where you can pledge to support the show on an episodic basis. You can also just click to do a one-time or a monthly recurring support via the PayPal link there. And lastly, you can buy merchandise on the website. And I'm thinking about starting to sell one new product, which I'll tell you about once I get it in my hands and can promote it a little bit further. And I do think there's a chance I'll have more of those Charlie and the Tortoise books on the website soon, so I'll be able to offer those signed copies. It's a new batch, a new printing, and I do think they upped the MSRP just a little bit, but hopefully we'll be in stock soon. In the meantime, though, I do want to thank those of you who supported the show this week. First and foremost, through PayPal, a lot of times I get, you know, little donations here and there. But this week we got a big support from Rob Schreck from Chicago. So thank you so, so much for your generous donation, Rob. And then through the Patreon portal, I want to thank Timothy Glover, Mark Hepburn, and Phil T-Bear. They are contributing at the highest level. And at the next highest level, I want to thank, let's do it in reverse order, Jeffrey Sewell, Brian Holden, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Jafe, Charles Payet, the Honorable Husband, Stuart Ogg, Jeffrey Perez, David Lacer, Christian Jeffrey, and Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa. Thank you guys so, so very much. All right. This week, I have a great, great guest. He's a super cool dude who has a very interesting story, and his titles are never ending. So let's see if I can get most of them in one fell swoop. He is a theoretical particle physicist. He's also a YouTuber. He has a comedy band called Ninja Sex Party and is a cast member on Game Grumps on YouTube. And he is a co-founder and producer of The Story Collider, which is like a live storytelling show that also has a podcast that accompanies it. Hopefully I didn't forget anything. If I did, I think we probably cover it on the show. So without any further ado, here he is, Brian Wecht. Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining me today.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So it's like a monsoon outside.
It is in Los Angeles.
It's. I think they said this is the worst storm we will have had in like years and years.
Is that
years.
True?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
It's
said something like 6 inches of rain, which I'm sure to people listening from anywhere else in the world is like, okay.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in New Jersey. This is nothing. Literally nothing.
Yeah. Texas too. It's nothing. But in LA, it's a really big deal because the infrastructure like doesn't allow for rain.
There's no drainage.
There's no drainage.
Right? You drive along the streets and there's just puddle. I mean, not puddles, but like these thick pools of water. People are trying to get their cars through.
It's like flooded everywhere. And then because it's been so windy, we have a lot of palm trees and the fronds fall off and they fill the road. And it's not like, you know, it's more like when there's a down tree than when you just lose some leaves. Like fronds are so big that you can't really sometimes drive over them.
Yeah, for sure. No, coming up here, I had to move around.
Swerve.
It was a little maze.
And of course, my house has no gutters, so it's like a pool of water in the front.
Yeah, mine too. It's kind of fun. It's a challenge just leaving the door every day, especially with we have a 2.5-year-old whose only goal when it rains is to find any puddle she can and just stomp in it as hard as possible.
See, she knows the joys and the pleasures of life.
It's the best. There's nothing better.
Why don't we do that?
We do sometimes. We're like, forget it. We'll just get wet and then stomp around in puddles outside.
I love that.
Kind of awesome.
So I have a 10-pound dog. So not only does he not want to go out in this, but when he does go out in this, he's drowning. Oh, he just walked in on cue. That's hilarious. He's drowning in it when he walks outside. You know, his stomach is just soaking wet when he comes back in. So we have to keep a towel by the back door so we can dry him off.
We have a 50-pound pit bull.
Oh.
But she's terrified of the rain. Like, will not go outside. So every time we do force her out so she can pee. Comes back in and it's like a greased pig trying to get her so we can towel her off.
Oh my gosh, that would be so hard. At least with him, I can scoop him up in a towel and kind of like baby swaddle him.
Yeah, we tried that, but it's like a two-person job to wrestle her and dry her off.
But we let him out twice today and he peed twice and I got home from the gym and my boyfriend was like, he crapped on the rug. I was like, yeah, I kind of expected that. He will not go poop outside in this. It just takes too long. It stresses him out. Yeah. Do you want to jump up here? Come on.
There he is.
Killer's joining us for the show. We'll see how long he wants to be here. He might give you guys a little bark, too, because it's crazy outside. So this morning I woke up, he was sleeping next to me, and I woke up to him growling at the wind, like you do.
I've only lived out here in less than 2 years now. Are there thunderstorms?
Get them out here? It does happen. We will get thunder and lightning, but it's not like Jersey or Texas, and they definitely don't come out of the blue. Like, everybody knows about it for days before a thunderstorm. They're like, batten down the hatches.
Yeah, I know. People are like loading up on supplies. And you must have grown up with hurricanes and stuff like that, right?
Not hurricanes, but tornadoes. Yeah, and in Texas, I mean, I think what most people know about it if they live there is that the weather is so unpredictable. It's just, 75 one day and then like a few hours and it'll be in the 40s. And you get these flash flood thunderstorms out of nowhere. And they're really violent, and then you have the tornado sirens going off and stuff. It's definitely not like that here in LA.
We did not have that in Jersey either. I mean, the weather was variable from day to day, but it wasn't just like, suddenly the heavens would open up and it would start raining.
Oh, yeah, that happens all the time in Texas. It's kind of amazing, but it's a little scary. But also, every Texan knows how to drive in the rain, and that's why it makes me insane in Los Angeles, because it's barely sprinkling and people are driving like there's 3 feet of snow on the road.
Yes.
I can't deal with
I've noticed they do it one of two ways. They either slow down to a crawl or they floor it, trying to get as if that getting to their destination faster will
make them
safer.
Yeah. It's like, come on, just don't drive in the lane where all the flooding is and you'll be fine.
My favorite is when people cancel plans just because it's raining.
Oh, that
like,
just happened today.
I can't come over today. It's raining. And you're like, what?
That literally just happened to me. Well, I'm supposed to meet up with a friend here in our neighborhood, and then we're going to go to Pasadena to do dinner. And I'm still meeting the people in Pasadena after, but the one friend that was going to come along for the ride was like, can I just meet you in the hood? I'm not going to go to Pasadena. the rain.
It's, it's not
bad.
Raining that hard either. It's just
so
raining.
Funny. But, the one thing I get about it is it does make you not want to get out of bed.
Oh, for sure.
You definitely want to wear sweatpants in this weather.
Especially when it's like a little bit chilly, like it is right now.
I love it. And we're drinking hot tea.
It's
oh my gosh. It's the best way to podcast, actually. there's a lot of talk about rain. I think we did that because you can probably hear it in the background. So get in the mood, y'all.
Yeah, setting the scene.
All right, so I'm super excited because, Brian, you have a super weird job, and you used to have also a super weird job, not so much for my podcast listeners because I have scientists on the show all the time, but you used to be a theoretical astrophysicist.
Not astrophysicist, just theoretical
particle physicist. Yep. Dang it. I have so many astrophysicists on the show. That seems to be like the trend, right? Mm-hmm. Astrophysicists are more the ones who do TV and radio interviews.
Yeah,
there
are a couple with particle physics. There are a couple notable examples like Brian Greene, right? Brian Cox actually, I think, is particle physics.
Yeah, but
as
even
well.
With Brian Greene, I think he's more known for string theory, which is particle physics, but it's like this bizarro version of it, right?
Exactly.
So, but you're right. He's not a cosmologist, but like mutual friends of ours, like Sean Carroll, he's definitely a cosmologist.
Neil Tyson
is a cosmologist. Astro.
So
you were a theoretical particle physicist and you no longer are, which is the funniest thing to say. I mean,
but
once
in some
a particle sense, physicist, always
literally
a
particle. Exactly what
for
I was
sure.
About to say.
Yeah. But you no longer work as a particle physicist.
Yeah,
and
that's
so,
right.
It's like, did you get bored?
Well, okay. So what I do now is I'm a YouTuber. Mm-hmm. So I have a couple of YouTube channels. And basically what happened was I had this, the whole time I was doing physics, so I went on the typical academic track, grad school, postdocs, and then eventually got a professor gig. I was also doing comedy and music on the side because I've always done that. And midway into my second postdoc, I was at the Institute for Advanced Study in Princeton. So I was going into New York to do comedy and music and stuff like that. I started a band slash YouTube channel called Ninja Sex Party. And then that just kind of kept going over the years. And, you know, I was moving around because I was an academic, and my partner, Dan, was largely based in New York, although then moved out here to L.A.
And he wasn't an academic.
No, not at all. Like, mm-hmm. he was basically a professional musician. I mean, he, like, lived in his car in Philly for a few years while he was struggling to make it.
I love,
like,
that you can do that in Philly.
I know.
I love Philly.
It was awesome. And when I met him, he was living... Have you ever been to the McKibben Lofts in Brooklyn?
I haven't.
It's like this kind of hipster commune, you know. So basically,
is it in Williamsburg? Where is it in Brooklyn?
It's in Bed-Stuy,
okay,
I think.
Yeah. So it's like super, yeah.
I mean, now it's like gentrified like crazy, but
that's
when
true,
we met,
I guess.
Yeah.
But Bed-Stuy was really yikes for a long time.
For
yeah.
sure. And I'm sure, actually, I haven't been over there in many years.
I think there's still areas there's just still a lot of projects in Bed-Stuy.
Yeah,
so
sure.
I think they're like pockets, but you're right. Everything's yeah. gentrified.
And
in New
when
York
I
now.
Met him, the answer to the question, how many people do you live with, was unclear. He was like, I think it's 15, but it might be 20. Because it's like, who is paying rent? Who's sleeping on the couch? Who's sleeping here?
And the crazy thing is, sometimes before I moved to New York, I visited a friend of a friend. Actually, I think it was like a friend of my boyfriend at the time, because I was going to go visit the campus where I ultimately went to school. And he was like, oh, we can stay with so-and-so. He lives in Williamsburg in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And we get there, and it's like an unmarked door.
Yep.
With no address, no anything behind like this big locked thing. And then it's like down in a creepy basement, and there are just all these unmarked doors in the basement. There's a shared bathroom at the end of the hall.
Yep.
And his quote unquote apartment is like got a makeshift wall up in the middle so that it's split into two rooms. And like, I don't think it was legal. I don't think it was legal. And there was kind of like standing water on the floor.
At the McKibben Lofts, they absolutely had these weird artificial divides to section off quote unquote rooms, and there were sandbags in the apartment to prevent flooding.
It's so great. And then you're like, dude, how much do you pay for this place? And he's like, $1,800 a month.
Right, exactly.
It's like, are you out of your mind?
So I met him. He's like the single guy living in this, you know, kind of weird hipster kind of hippie place.
Mm.
And I was just married, you know, I was an academic, and he's this unemployed kind of musician. I think he was working at Midtown Comics.
And where were you living?
I was living in Metuchen, New Jersey.
Okay.
So we basically picked a place that was kind of in the midpoint between Princeton and Manhattan.
Makes sense.
And so we started this thing, this band and YouTube channel. And as I was going through my academic career, the YouTube stuff just kind of kept going. And then, long story short, eventually the YouTube channel became so popular that it was a second full-time job. And in the meantime, my wife and I had a kid. And so I was a dad and a full-time professor and a full-time YouTuber. And I was like, something's...
Yeah, it's like three full-time jobs.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of had to pick one and stick with it. Obviously, the parenting thing wasn't going anywhere.
Like, I'll just put that on the shelf until she's like 17.
Exactly. So I, after many months of stressing out, because I had, the UK doesn't have tenure. They have de facto tenure, but...
Okay.
So I had a permanent, what's called a permanent job, which mm-hmm. is like tenure here. But anyway, it would be very difficult for me to be fired. It was like a permanent position over there.
Gotcha.
So I went through this whole thing of like, should I give up this basically lifetime job security for a career in entertainment, which is
like totally freelance and undefined.
Literally the opposite of job security.
And you're like, yeah, I'll do it.
Yeah. So and luckily my wife was on board, and after talking about, you know, is this the right decision? Did she want to move to LA? That sort of thing. We went for it.
I love that. And so how long have you been here in LA? You said 2 years?
Just under. Yeah.
Just under 2 years.
We moved out here July 2015.
So you did an undergrad straight into a PhD, or did you take time off?
I took 1 year to teach high school.
Okay. So, but you did a bachelor's and then a PhD. You didn't do a bachelor's, then master's, then PhD.
Yeah. I mean, I did the thing where like I could have checked a box. Actually, I did do this.
The pass through.
I checked a box and got a master's, but... You know, that was just the first year of classes.
Yeah. And then you did two full postdocs. How long were those?
I did
one and a half.
Four postdocs.
Four.
So that's four postdocs total.
Holy shit.
3 years at MIT,
uh-huh.
3 years at the Institute for Advanced Study, 1 year at the University of Michigan, and then 1 year at Harvard.
So do people in physics, I have a friend who is one of Brian Greene's students, and he's like perpetually doing postdocs. I mean, at this point, I think he's actually moved over into another field as well, but he never really got a permanent faculty position. He would just keep going from postdoc to postdoc. Yeah. Is that just because it's sometimes hard to find a job, or is it a choice that people make because they don't feel like they're ready?
No. Rational person would say, well, I'm not ready for a faculty position.
Yeah, like I want to do four postdocs in a row.
It's just there are very few jobs, and like many academic fields, the hiring is, you know, certain fields are popular in certain years and unpopular in others. And like when I graduated in 2004, string theory jobs were, so I was more or less a string theorist, even though what I really worked on was supersymmetry and quantum field theory.
Yeah, but there's a lot of crossover there, right?
Yeah, for sure. And so string theory jobs, which had really peaked in like the late 90s, early 2000s, were going downhill because the LHC was about to start and everyone was very excited about what's called phenomenology, which is basically particle physics.
But like experimental particle physics.
Well, yeah, but I'm talking right now, even just in the theoretical job arc, because theory jobs are sort of, you know, are a different thing than experimental jobs.
So there's
blah, blah, blah.
Theoretical particle physics that still kind of utilize some of the understandings from CERN and from but they're still doing the theory stuff.
That's right. So roughly speaking, there are kind of two, sometimes people call it three camps of particle physicists, theorists. There are more formal mathematical people, basically string theorists, although these lines are a little fuzzy. And then there are what are called phenomenologists, which are people who are dealing with either current experiments or future experiments, basically anything you might potentially measure. Whereas like string theorists are typically not doing kind of data-driven
stuff. So you're not really doing the measuring when you're a phenomenologist. You're doing what a lot of people might do in other branches. Like in biology and psychology, you might do this a lot where you are taking the data from another lab. You're pulling like database data and then you're doing a lot of manipulation with it and theorizing based on the physical.
There's a bit of that. And then there's also people, actually most of the people when I was coming up as a young physicist who were phenomenologists were doing, it wasn't even so much data driven because the LHC hadn't started yet.
Oh yeah.
It was, you know, what models might we make of what the LHC might see and what tests could you make to check this model? So by model, I mean set of particles and interactions. So if you were a phenomenologist who was interested in supersymmetry or whatever, you would say, okay, well, I think these particles are going to behave like this, and here's a thing you can check to see if this is right. And then when the LHC comes online, here's a test that they could do to check it.
Gotcha.
So it's not even, it wasn't even data driven.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, well, in however many years, check this and see if it works.
This is what's so funny about theorists in physics in general, is that when they're like, oh, I'm going to go back to the lab. Like the lab is a computer. Or, you know what I mean?
Or a pad.
Or a notebook. Right. Yeah. There's no, it's so funny because it's still hours and hours of work the lab, but there's no equipment in the lab.
We're super cheap.
Yeah. Like the extent of it, I think you mentioned this to me the other day, that kind of the most extreme version would be needing to go to a supercomputer somewhere.
Pretty much. Yeah. And then that was relatively rare among people I knew. Most of the stuff you could do on even a laptop. You didn't even need a desktop. But
that's crazy.
Yeah. So all the computationally intensive stuff I did on Mathematica on my laptop.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah. So I had a podcast a few weeks ago now, maybe a few months ago now, where I was invited to go down to Austin and moderate a panel at the Paramount Theater between Michio Kaku, Brian Greene, and James Sylvester Gates. Mm-hmm. And so three string theorists coming from, you know, different schools of thought a little bit, different labs and things. But we dove super deep into string theory, like what is it and what does it mean and what could it tell us and how theoretical is it really? Is there any experimental evidence? And all of them, I think, collectively at various levels said like it could all be bullshit. Like it could all
It would be intellectually dishonest to not admit that.
Yeah. And some of them were like, and it's not just like, oh, there's a sliver of a chance. It's like there's a pretty good chance that this isn't anything, but it makes sense on paper and it's one of the best kind of options we have right now for sort of reconciling, you know, quantum gravity and some of these things. So,
yeah.
So we had a great chance to do a deep dive. Was what you were studying very similar to probably some of the things we talked about in that episode, or were you on like a different kind of tack?
Well, let's see. So probably the guy of those three that I had the most research stuff in common with would be mm-hmm. Gates.
Okay.
Because he's a supersymmetry guy. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's kind of an old school supersymmetry guy, but in fact, he was around at the very beginning of supersymmetry. I forget.
I think he was one of like the architects of some of that, right?
Yeah, he and other collaborators of his. Mm-hmm. It's a very interesting story, at least to me anyway. They kind of developed this way of thinking about supersymmetry in this language, which other people like Warren Siegel, I think is part of this crowd as well, have this very particular language and way of thinking about supersymmetry that is peculiar to them. Like their notation is something that really only they use.
Oh, interesting.
And I mean, you can decipher it. It's not like it's impossible to tell what
they're
saying.
But you can tell exactly who they are based on looking at their notes.
So, but if you read their papers, you can be like, oh, that's a Gates paper sort of thing.
That's cool.
But since I was a supersymmetry guy, I probably had the most in common with him. And I definitely read his papers, and he was doing all sorts of interesting stuff.
Yeah, he was really great in the panel. I think it was
awesome.
Absolutely. It was funny because I tried to stay away from it, but I can't remember if somebody in the audience asked a question about God, or more if I was trying to ask about how they feel when theoretical particle physicists or physics is sort of bastardized in like quantum woo-woo.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, like movies like What the Bleep Do We Know and things where people start to try to talk about consciousness in that way. And I think that Michio Kaku was the most sort of of an apologist of that.
Oh,
and,
for sure.
But very funny
about
it.
The kind
of
stuff
it.
He does.
Exactly.
Right? I mean,
and like,
not to denigrate him.
No. But. And the funny thing is, the more that I got to know him, the more I really appreciated that like a lot of it was grain of salt. And a lot of it he's kind of doing in jest.
Yeah.
Like when he says God in the same way Einstein talked about God. Like I think some people take him to heart, but mm-hmm. I absolutely was like, I don't think this guy believes in God. But I do think he thinks that like God is a word we use for some sort of cosmic whatever the fuck. Brian Greene, of course, was much more like materialist like me.
Right.
I could connect with him. And then Gates, he never explicitly said it, but I was like, I think this guy might be religious.
Yeah, I have no idea.
Which is, it's so interesting to me that there is such a variation within within even particle physicists who you think are probably all atheists.
Yeah, I mean, default definitely is mm-hmm. atheists. But I know a few, I've had colleagues who were deeply devout mm-hmm. Catholics, you know, definitely a few colleagues who were practicing Jews, but not super devout, but definitely practiced religion.
I've definitely found it's easier for Jews to have more of a range of kind of like culturally Jewish and not at all religious, or even if they are religious, it's not very what's the word? Like even there's nothing evangelical about it, and so and not even literal, you know.
Yeah,
and there are some Christian sects where it's much easier, I think, to reconcile sort of the teachings of Jesus with these deep physical phenomena, but it does become harder the more sort of literal.
Yeah,
you know,
and I had a lot of Israeli collaborators too, mm-hmm. and of course, for a lot of Israelis, the whole country is tied up in their identity, and you can't separate the country from the religion.
But so much of it is just like cultural.
Yeah, exactly. You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. I had my friend Jason Goldman. I don't know. So he's been on the show a couple of times, and we've talked a little bit about being, because he's the most Jewish person I've ever met and the most atheist person I've ever met, and so it's so great because on the flip side of that, I've had. David Silverman on the show who, mm-hmm. you know, and he's like super fire brand.
Right.
And he's like, you can't be an atheist Jew. And I'm like, okay. So it's been great to hear those different perspectives. But you're actually sort of involved in that community. Maybe not so much, I don't know, I don't want to put words in your mouth. Maybe not so much the atheist community, but definitely the skeptic community, right?
Yeah, for sure. So I've done stuff with Nexus for many years. And I mean, that actually is more or less what I do with the skeptics community is through Nexus.
Yeah, and that's a much heavier science angle than some of the straight skeptic things where it's really about like debunking Bigfoot and, you know, other cryptozoology and
stuff. My connection to that, so I started listening to the SGU, it wasn't quite the first skeptics thing I did, but I forget how I came across it. So this is probably 10 plus years ago. That sounds right, right?
They've been around for 11 years.
Yeah, okay. So probably their second or third year, something like that, I started listening to it. And
was it before or after Perry had passed away?
It was after.
It was after, but when Rebecca was there.
Yes.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah. So you're right. Probably about 9 years ago.
Yeah.
Like that
sounds about right. I just had heard, I think, recommended as a science podcast, that sort of thing. And I listened, I was like, oh, this is really great. And they were talking about Nexus. Mm-hmm. And this was, I think, the first year I was living in Jersey at the time. And I went to check it out.
Yeah. It's right there because it's in New York. Well, I don't know back then, but now it's in New York.
Yeah. It was in New York.
Yeah.
And for the in-between speakers, they bring on George Robb.
I love George.
And I was like, wait a minute. My biology teacher was a George Robb senior who I know has a son named George Robb Jr.
No.
And so
George's dad's a biology teacher?
Yeah, he started out at my high school as a PE teacher. And then apparently when I had him for biology in ninth grade, and I'm kind of blowing the punchline here, even though I'm sure you can see it coming. It was his first year teaching science.
No.
Yeah. And so after he was done with his set, I went up to George and I was like, hey, man, I think I had your dad for bio. And he was like, yes, you did. So we talked a little.
That's hilarious. We had
gone to the same school. Are you guys the same age? He's a little older than
okay.
I. Okay. Yeah. But I had an older cousin who went to that school that he knew a little bit. And then through George, actually, I remember I stayed in touch with him a little bit. I wrote him an email and I said, just basically saying, hey, you know, I love the SGU and I heard him talking about something. If you ever wanted to introduce me, I would love to talk to those guys. And that's how I met Jay and Steve.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, we just recently had you on, didn't we? To talk about
a couple months ago.
Yeah, some physics story that was in the news.
The five problems solved with one tweak thing.
Oh, yeah. That was kind of flash in the pan, wasn't it? Uh-huh. Like nobody followed up on that.
Nope. So it's thanks to George, really, that I started doing anything with the skeptics community just because he was nice enough to introduce me to Jay. And then I got involved. Then basically what happened is then I was a speaker at Nexus.
Yeah.
And then
really involved, right?
Yeah. Now I'm on the organizing committee and,
gotcha.
And stuff like that.
Yeah, I have to say that George is probably my favorite discovery of
he's the
skeptic
best.
Community.
I love him.
He's
just,
incredible.
He's just such a sweet guy and a phenomenally talented musician, composer.
And a phenomenally talented, like, MC.
Yeah,
like,
he's the best.
He's always everyone's go-to because mm-hmm. he's so entertaining. And
he's just so good at what he does. He's a total professional. He's just, he's just the best. I literally can't think of a single bad thing about him. I love him.
Which is great, too, because sometimes I think the skeptics community gets a little bit of a bad rap, right? There are different angles to it and different approaches and different like groups that split out.
Yeah.
I think the core message and the core strategy of being a skeptical activist or being a skeptical thinker is something we can all get behind. Even
for sure.
People who aren't skeptics can get behind it.
Which is basically think about stuff.
Yeah, think about stuff and maybe like apply some scientific reasoning to it and don't be so truthy. As in Colbert's truthiness. Uh-huh. But with the skeptics movement, just like with any movement, it's made up of people. And oftentimes there tend to be more white male people than other types of people. And then you might get some of the weird MRA types, the men's rights activists, or like the people who are pointing the, recessive left or not recessive. What's the word I'm looking for?
Regressive.
Regressive. Thank you. The regressive left finger pointers.
Yeah, yeah.
And then, you know, it's really hard because when your core message is just think about stuff, but you have people on different ends of the political spectrum, there's infighting there.
For sure. And I didn't realize when I started doing skeptic stuff, or I did a few like talks here and there, and I didn't realize that. So of course I knew skepticism was an outgrowth of the atheist movement to some extent.
To some extent, but some people like to keep it so separate.
Right. And I didn't realize that there were a lot of people from the atheist movement who were like all in conspiracy theory kind of people. Yeah. So
I didn't know that either.
I didn't either. And so I would give talks and occasionally there'd be like whatever skeptics group I was at would have me in for a thing. And this happened a couple times before I recognized it as a pattern. There'd be some kind of older person there and they would ask some like way out of left field question. I remember one guy asking me once, he was like, when I was growing up, there were two galaxies outside our galaxy and now they're gone. How do you explain that?
And you're like, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Exactly. And I'm like, well, galaxies don't disappear. So, I didn't even understand the question.
Maybe we thought they were galaxies and it turned out they were farther away and they were a different phenomenon. You know, like those Messier objects or Messier objects. At the beginning, they were just all fuzzy things in the sky.
Right.
Like nobody knew what any of them were.
Right. And so maybe data got better and things were reclassified.
Yeah. And we realized, that's a cluster and it's not a galaxy. It
Just
looked like one.
So anyway, I asked after the second or third time this happened, I was like, why are old guys asking insane questions all the time? And the last time it happened, maybe this was not the case with the first two, but it seemed like a reasonable guess. They were like, oh, well, he's sort of a holdover from the atheist group. And, you know, a bunch, they've been so, they kind of went away and they were subsumed into the skeptics group.
Interesting.
And he, you know, he's not really a science guy. He's more of a, you know, sort of anarchist, conspiracy theorist, atheist.
Just very anti-religion and all the garbage that comes with that. Yeah, and but then, that doesn't always mean that you're a critical thinker.
Right,
not
which is
at
something
all.
I never even thought of because at least in my...
they all go together.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I actually came to skepticism through atheism. I was an atheist first. Then I became a scientist. And I never knew there was an atheist movement. I openly talked about my atheism separately in blogs and things. And then people would start to reach out and say, do you want to speak at this event? And I got to be good friends with David Silverman. Mm-hmm. And so I would come on. I wrote the foreword to his book, actually.
Oh,
we
yeah,
don't
cool.
agree on almost anything, but I think that's why he chose me.
That's awesome.
And so I did a lot of stuff there. And then the guys reached out to me. I had been to like Skepticon, maybe Aposticon. But again, I kind of thought of it all as the same thing.
Yeah.
And then the guys reached out to me on
the
Skeptics Guide.
Yeah.
And they were like, hey, do you want to be our new co-host? And I was like, sure, but I don't consider myself part of this community. I don't. And they're like, first of all, you're a skeptic. And second of all, the fact that you're not like in all of the drama is like the most attractive thing about you.
Yeah.
So it's really funny because when I work with them, sometimes they'll like mention things that have happened in the past, or they'll talk about like blah, blah, blah gate or blah, blah. And I'm like, I don't know what any of this stuff is.
Yeah.
And they're like, we're going to keep you pure.
That I try to avoid all that stuff as well, because
yeah.
I'm not super involved in the rest of the skeptics community. I tend to see it like on certain people's Facebook feeds. I'm like, oh, there's a thing happening.
Yeah,
there's drama
exactly.
happening. Okay, well, read a little bit about it.
Yeah,
all
I'm
right,
like
great.
An anthropologist.
Yeah,
I'm like, oh,
exactly.
let me kind of make sure that I have enough knowledge to not put my foot in my mouth. But
yeah, and half the time it's like, well, I like people on both sides of this argument,
too.
And I don't really know what's going on, so I'm just going to kind of stay out of this one because what's the
what
use
good
of
could
getting
come
involved?
Of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's either that I like people on both sides or I'm like, I don't know who these people are.
Right.
Like, I don't know why
yeah.
this is relevant. And it's always dumb shit. It's always social shit, sexual shit, somebody's feelings got hurt, political shit, whatever
right.
the case may be. It doesn't get down to the core beliefs. And I'm not saying it's illegitimate when I say it's dumb shit. It's not illegitimate.
No, for
like
sure.
A lot of times it's really important.
Inspires important conversations
absolutely.
About, you know, harassment and
inclusion,
you know, how women
and,
are treated and minorities are treated at skeptics conferences. All this stuff is super important to talk about.
I definitely feel like the science community has a leg up on that for sure. We
well,
still struggle
sure.
with it, but I think there's more. And maybe it's because there's so much crossover with psychology and sociology between that and sort of the biological sciences, and then you move into the physical sciences.
Yeah.
Yes, like physics, for example, and engineering and computer science have the least women, the least
for sure.
people of color, the least, you know. But I definitely think that when I go to science conferences and they have like non-gendered bathrooms and they have like a harassment policy, and we try to do that with SciComm Camp. I don't know where it comes from, but they're definitely way more ahead of the curve. I'm starting to see that more with skeptic conferences
yeah,
and
yeah.
atheist conferences, but I don't think that they've always been kind of at the front of the curve.
I didn't see it super much, to be honest, in physics conferences, but it really is. It's so
it's
white
all dudes.
Male
yeah.
that it's almost, I mean, it's not exclusively, but if it's like 10% women at a typical conference,
mm-hmm.
I'd be shocked. Like, even that seems high to me, unfortunately.
Yeah, that's and it is changing, which is great.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think that there's, like, at Caltech, which is a heavy, heavy, like, physics and engineering and math school, right? They don't
mm-hmm.
even offer certain... Like, I have friends who have neuroscience degrees from Caltech, but they don't actually have neuroscience degrees because you can't get a neuroscience degree
oh,
there.
Really?
They actually are chemists or they're economists
oh, wow.
or they're, but they like focused on aspects of neuroscience. Yeah. The only way you can do neuroscience at Caltech is computational.
Huh.
That's the only neuroscience track.
Wild.
So if you want to do, like, one of my best friends, Crystal Dilworth, she's been on the show. She has a neuroscience degree, but it's molecular chemistry.
Hmm.
She just happened to study molecules in the brain.
Yeah.
But yeah. So, but even there, I think they have gender parity at the undergrad level, which is great.
That's
yeah.
awesome.
It's getting to be closer and closer that at the under, I mean, we still have the leaky pipeline problem, but back when I was an undergrad, the physics department had very few women.
Oh yeah, for me too. Well, I mean, I was a math music double major mm-hmm. at Williams College, and Williams, music was of course pretty balanced as
yeah,
you
yeah,
guess,
usually.
But physics, I think Williams was better than most, because there were, I mean, math was this, math at Williams was and is this like super inclusive, you know, really rah-rah supportive environment.
That's
in the
great.
Best. Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I think when I was there were, you know, each class is like 500 people and 10%-ish were math majors at a liberal arts college, mm-hmm. which is just huge.
Yeah, it's that is really big they, for
yeah, a but they would department. Hire these like just amazing, amazing faculty members who were just the best.
And so were they a little more inclusive because of that?
I think so.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, it was definitely, it wasn't 50-50, but it probably was, you know, 60-40 or something
that's
like that.
Great.
And also a lot of double majors. Mm-hmm. So that's it.
I didn't see the issues with gender parity as much when I was, or lack of gender parity when I was an undergrad because I was a psych major mm-hmm. as an undergrad. And that's like predominantly women.
Yeah, for
so
sure.
I never really ran into all the issues that I then noticed when I, because instead of going straight to my PhD, I did a separate master's degree at my home university for my undergrad. So I actually changed departments. I was in the psych department for my undergrad, and then I went into the biology department for my master's in
neuroscience. Which is still a lot of women, right?
It's still a lot of women, but it was drastic. And because I was in an electrophysiology lab, a lot of the students in my lab were physics majors.
Right.
And so I would go to the physics machine shop to fix something because we didn't have a machine shop in neuro. And like one of my friends would be like, let me take you. You shouldn't be alone in those hallways. Like they're like rabid dogs down there.
Yeah.
I haven't seen a woman in weeks. So I'm like, oh, okay.
I mean, machine shop is always a special place.
Pretty crazy. Well, I'm really interested in, we could dive back and maybe we will, maybe I'll detour back into some particle physics stuff, but I'm actually really interested in talking about the cool stuff that you do now with science communication and with, we haven't even mentioned Story Collider, so that's going to be great. But first, I want to take a quick break to thank the sponsors of this week's episode. Well, once again, I'm pleased to be partnered this week with Audible, and there's a special offer that they have just for you, the Talk Nerdy listener. You get a free audiobook with your 30-day trial membership. All you've got to do is go to audible.com/try now, browse through all of the different books that are offered, and download a free title. Just start listening at audible.com/try now, TRYNOW. The reason that I like to partner with Audible and I support them just week after week is because I think that they have something really special to offer. If you are not new to the show, I'm sure you know that reading is very important. To me, I think that reading is incredibly important for the skeptical process, for critical thinking, for having a scientific mindset. And what better way to be able to get all of your reading in with your busy schedule? You know, you're at the gym, you're on the subway, you're in the car, than to be able to break it up and listen to some of the books that you want to take in. Audible offers an unmatched selection of not just audiobooks, but original audio shows, news, comedy, magazine, newspapers. I mean, just a ton of content that's audio content. But why not pick a book, especially one that's been recently featured on this very show? Looking back at some of the past episodes, the really recent episodes, I interviewed Helen Chersky, who wrote a great book called Storm in a Teacup. I interviewed Storm in a Teacup, The Physics of Everyday Life. Don't want to shortchange that. I recently interviewed Dava Sobel. She wrote an incredible, incredible book called The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. Who else would be a great book to follow up on? Oh, Lydia Pine. She wrote Seven Skeletons, The Evolution of the World's Most Famous Human Fossils. And of course, there's Simon Singh. He's written a few books, The Code Book, The Simpsons and Their Mathematical Secrets, all of which you can find on Audible, and you can catch up, I think, on some of the best critical thinking possible. So what are you waiting for? Go there right now. It's audible.com/try now. You will get a free audiobook with your 30-day trial membership. That's audible.com/try now. All right, let's get back to the show. So we are back with Brian Wecht.
Hello.
Is it Wecht or like Wecht?
Wecht.
Wecht.
Thoroughly Americanized. Wecht.
Okay. Where's it from?
It is unclear to everybody in my family.
It sounds German to me.
Yeah, I was always told like Russian-Polish border. Mm-hmm. It's Jewish of some Ashkenazi, you know, stripe.
And are you Ashkenazi?
My father's family.
Your father. Yeah. So technically you're not a Jew, huh?
Technically, no. No, I was raised. My mother was Christian. My father was Jewish. My father's mother faked a heart attack so she wouldn't go to their wedding because my father was marrying a Christian girl.
Snap.
Yeah. but I was raised Episcopalian.
Okay.
Which is my mother's.
So you were a Christmas every year, not Chrismica.
Yeah. So we did, we did a lot of like we were talking about earlier, culturally Jewish stuff, but anything explicitly related. I mean, I went to cousins, bar mitzvahs and stuff like that. But any explicitly religious stuff we did in my family was pretty much all Christian. But like, for example, our Christmas Eve dinner every year was kosher deli food.
So we tried
to combine the traditions.
It's funny how many, my boyfriend came from a mixed family like that too. And, he's atheist now and doesn't identify with any of it. Yeah. But growing up, it was there was a Christmas tree and a menorah.
Right.
I don't know.
Yeah.
It's funny to me. Growing up Mormon, it's so, especially for the first few years of your life, you aren't even aware that there are non-Mormons.
Right.
It's just this is how it is for everyone. So it's interesting to me when I get to learn about other people's upbringing and other people's approaches to religion.
I think it's pretty common also in, Jersey, New York, to have mixed Christian Jewish families.
Absolutely.
I feel like half the people I went to school, elementary, high school, whatever, with had a Jewish parent and a Christian parent.
Absolutely. And in Texas, I knew two Jews.
Yep.
Two. I went to one of their bar mitzvahs. There was a Stein and a Diamond. They were my only Jewish friends. And eventually a Bosky. That was when I was a little older. But that was the extent. And they were all very, there was no orthodoxy. They're super reformed, super chill.
Right.
They may have gone to Hebrew school, but definitely nobody had went to Jewish day school. And there was not. And
Yeah. We didn't really have that. I mean, definitely there's a big Orthodox community, of course, in New York.
And in LA.
In LA too. In New Jersey, there must be one, but everybody, I didn't know any really hardcore Orthodox Jews. Everyone was reform and pretty mellow.
I think I've told the story before, but when I first moved to New York from Texas, which was the biggest culture shock anyway, I lived in Forest Hills in Queens, mm-hmm. and outside of my balcony window, there was it wasn't really a synagogue. It was a Jewish center.
Like
I don't know what they're
center
called. Yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah. And it was Yom Kippur, maybe? Oh, I'm totally fucking this. There's a specific name for this tradition.
Is it Purim? Was it Purim
maybe.
When they
it was
went?
With a chicken?
Oh, no, I don't even know.
No, there's something. And I mentioned it to my contractor, and he was like, holy shit, your entree into Judaism was that? So I'm looking out the window, and there's a rabbi, and he's holding the Torah, and he's got a chicken, and he's doing all this crazy shit with the chicken, and then they would sacrifice the chicken.
Oh, wow.
And
no, I have no idea what you're talking about.
Yeah, and you would see these chicken coops at this time of year all over at these, kosher kind of, places, and it would be, chickens for sale. And I guess it was a tradition where you'd kind of put the sins into the chicken and then sacrifice the
really?
Chicken.
Oh.
It was very strange. But I was like, what is this? What did I move into? And now, of course, all my friends are Jewish because I live in L.A. And and there's, Hasidic Jews walking around the streets and stuff.
Oh,
here.
Sure. So, it blew my mind when I found out that, to a real Orthodox Jew, I am not even vaguely Jewish.
Oh, absolutely
not.
I
was like, these people do not, I look at these guys on the street and I recognize some commonality, at least ancestrally between us. That is not a two-way
No,
thing.
Absolutely not. Because these are the guys who, I think this happened also to my boyfriend once. He was walking around his neighborhood and he is technically Jewish. His mom is Jewish, but he doesn't ascribe to it at all. So he kind of was not the nicest when he did this, but somebody walked up to him on the Sabbath, right, and was like, are you Jewish? And he was like, no. And they were like, I need you to turn my refrigerator, something mm-hmm. had happened at their house.
Oh, yeah.
And they needed to do something because if they hadn't, something would go wrong. And he was like, Jesus Christ, went in the house and helped them flip the switch or whatever, because it's a totally different world.
Yeah
We just don't have that.
There was a town not far from where I grew up in New Jersey that had, I might be getting this slightly wrong, but basically had a magic line, I think it's called an eruv, outside, so that you could go outside, but it defined outside to be inside. Uh-oh. So you could say technically you were inside because you were inside the boundary of this line. And you could check online if the line was activated or not.
Oh my God.
So it had a website. And I say this not to ridicule it at all.
Yeah,
but
no,
it's
but
just
it is.
It's the thing that fascinates me the most about Judaism and always has is the
hacks.
The way in which it's all about obeying the letter of the law, but not the spirit.
Absolutely.
Right? You're going to try to work that that text as hard as you can to find a way around it.
You saw the
and
phone that
I really
respect
that
undials, right?
Yeah.
It's randomly dying all, so you undial the number, and that's so funny.
Or the, you know, in Israel, like the elevators that on the Sabbath stop at every floor.
Yeah,
so
and
that
then
you
don't have
to push them.
And it's yeah. so common now that like my refrigerator, so we have like Miele, like fancy appliances yeah, when yeah. we did our big house renovation. Our refrigerator has a Sabbath setting. I don't know
oh,
what
wow.
that means,
uh-huh.
but it's a Sabbath setting. So
that's
it's like
wild.
So common, and people, I guess, need that to incorporate into it. Because actually, some of those aspects of the faith aren't even like, they're not Hasidic, they're a little more Orthodox, mm-hmm. but they're definitely not like full Hasidic Jews that require that. It's just people that aren't like fucking atheists like you.
Right.
Dirty atheists. So anyway, we haven't even talked about some of the really cool, you mentioned it at the beginning, but some of the really cool SciComm stuff that mm-hmm. you do now. So the YouTube channel that was gaining the success, Ninja Sex Party.
Yes.
Are you still doing that?
Oh yeah. Yeah. That's a big part of what
I do.
And
is that
now.
Your main YouTube? Do you have more YouTube channels now?
I have two YouTube channels. So one, Ninja Sex Party, is one I started, and that's honestly what I spend most of my time mm-hmm. doing. We're a musical comedy, so I write the songs, we shoot music videos, and we just started touring.
That's awesome.
Yeah, so we've been playing. We sold out the Wiltern a couple months ago. And
like, is it different genres to go with the different songs, or do you have like one genre, like your sound, and then it's just the comedy aspect that changes?
It varies a bit, but generally speaking, our style is very like 80s synth pop.
Okay.
But we kind of move around a lot in between genres.
But not like Flight of the Conchords, where like
no,
they,
not quite
you
that
embody
much.
A kind of a genre by the song itself, and
yeah,
you actually
no.
change your costuming and stuff.
Not really. I mean, most of what we do is, like, our last album was very kind of hair metal-y, but there was one song we did which sounded kind of like a medieval ballad. And so we do try, you know, just to make it interesting, try to move around genre-wise a little bit. But generally speaking, it's like 80s synth pop.
And is that just because you love 80s synth pop?
It was actually because it's what, so for up until about a year ago, mm-hmm. everything we were doing music-wise, I was just doing myself on my computer for the instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And the instruments I could get to sound the best were synthesizers, because otherwise it sounded like kind of derpy trumpets and stuff.
Yeah, definitely when you're doing a lot of, you're right. Like computerized, it's much better when they have that already computerized
yeah,
sound.
Exactly.
And so, do you play any instruments?
Yeah, I play keyboards and I play a bunch of woodwinds. So I play saxophone, clarinet.
I love that.
I used to play a lot of tuba, but I haven't done that in many, many years.
Oh, I
now.
Love it. So dorky. It's the dorkiest instrument you can play. It's the tuba.
It's because in high school band, I played Barry sax. So I was always on the bass line, and my band leader was like, you should just learn to play tuba because you're basically playing tuba parts anyway. So just learn to play it. And then
you were like, this is way less cool.
Yep. But in college, I was a member of it was technically a marching band, mm-hmm. but it was really like a stay in one formation, then scramble into another
gotcha.
During the football games. And then I got to play sousaphone for that.
Neat.
And we had this like giant white fiberglass sousaphone that I got to traipse around with. And that was, yeah, I mean, it's not the coolest instrument in the world, but it was definitely, there's something about the raw power of a sousaphone that is just
pretty
unmatched.
Cool.
Yeah. Especially when it's this weird, like, white fiberglass thing.
It's very Soussian.
Indeed.
I should say. There used to be an ad on MTV, I remember, it was like a cartoon dude, and there was a meter, kind of like you would see on, like, your equalizer, mm-hmm. and it was like sexual interest or whatever, like sexuality based on instrument. And the first guy was like, you know, a metal guitarist with the long hair. It was like, and went all the way up. And then it was like, you know, the drummer. And then the last one was tuba. And it was like, it was like so sad.
Yeah.
Like,
I'll always love the tuba, though.
That's great. I think that's awesome.
I will say in college, I played it a lot. And when October came around, there was this like spike in the number of gigs I'd get because it was Oktoberfest season.
Oh, so
me and a couple other students formed this little oompa band
mm-hmm.
That would play like 6 or 7 gigs just in October. Essentially, we'd play, they barely even pay us. They'd just feed us sausages and then that would be it. And then, you know, that was the bulk of my tuba playing.
So wait, you said that you played a lot of brass. Did you also say you played woodwinds?
Yeah, woodwinds mainly were what I did.
Oh, really?
So mainly saxophone for many years. Saxophone was my main instrument, but I also played clarinet.
Do you know what my
favorite
instrument is?
What's that?
Oboe.
Oboe is beautiful.
Oboe is so beautiful. It's so sad. It's like a super depressing instrument. Yeah. Like, but it's gorgeous.
I love the English horn, right? Which is the slightly larger oboe thing. I just there's something about the tone. It's a little mellower and it still gives that oboe sensibility, but sort of takes the edge off a little bit.
Sure, because oboe has like a deep kind of granular.
Yeah.
It's so pretty. That goes so well with strings to me. That's the kind of music that just really moves me the most. Okay, so and your musical partner in Ninja Sex Party, you only have one bandmate?
So Ninja Sex Party is technically the two of us, and his name is Dan.
And what does he play?
He's just a vocalist.
Oh, okay. So you do all the backing tracks, and then he sings. It's kind of like Postal Service.
Yeah, so it was that way up until about a year ago, and then we started working with this four-piece band from Toronto called TWRP, where basically they're kind of like a Daft Punk sort of disco pop thing. They all dress up in these awesome costumes.
Does anybody play guitar?
Yes.
Yes.
Yes. The main vocalist plays, his character name is Dr. Sung, and he plays guitar and talkbox.
Yes.
So
God.
Like drums, guitar, bass, guitar/talkbox. They're the best. And so now all of the tracks we do there are band on it. And so I do synths and keyboards, but then the rest of the instruments going from, instead of being purely digital like they were when I was doing it myself,
you have more of
are
that
now played by them.
New wavy kind of sound.
Yeah, and they're awesome. They're actually literally just going back to Toronto today. They were out here for a month, and we recorded all these new songs and shot.
So exciting.
We're doing a cover album coming up, and we shot a video for, we did a cover of Pour Some Sugar on Me by Def Leppard, and we hired a bunch of porn stars to dress up in candy bikinis and throw Skittles at us.
Did you change all the lyrics?
Nope.
Or you just covered it.
Our covers. So we've have this weird kind of dichotomy now where we have our comedy albums that we release, all original comedy songs. And then last year we put out a straight ahead cover album of 70s and 80s songs. We did like Rock With You by Michael Jackson.
But then do you kind of change the sound at all?
So
make it a little more synth poppy.
Yeah. And we move around a little on the genre for those two. Most of those were pretty straight ahead
covers.
But that did really well, and so we're just in the middle of wrapping the next cover album right now.
Oh, fun. Do you wear costumes? Are you like Devo? I love Devo.
Yes. I dress up as a ninja, so I'm in full ninja costume. I'm also a Devo fanatic.
Oh, my God, fanatic. Love it.
Love Devo.
Love it. Which is rare, I think. I mean, people do like Devo. They do. But Gates of Steel is the greatest song ever.
That is a great song.
There are definitely people who, like, don't get it. Do you also like... You might not. Do you like any punk rock? Is that kind
I don't
of
know.
Feed-in?
I mean, I like, yes. I mean, I like what I like what I hear, but I didn't do any like super deep dives into punk.
Sure, sure. But since you like that kind of synthy poppy sound, see, one of my favorite band, I shouldn't even call it a band because it's one dude, and I know one other person on the face of the planet that
what
actually likes him, Adam and His Package.
I've heard of him, but I don't know anything about him.
I think you would love Adam and His Package, like just based on the kind of sound that he has a very particular voice, and sometimes people have a hard time with certain sounds just because of the voice. Like, I also really, really love a band called Coheed and Cambria.
Oh, yeah, Coheed, actually,
but
they
some people
were
hate
on,
Claudio's voice.
What's the guy's name? Miguel, is that the main who's the main guy?
Claudio,
sorry,
yeah.
He was on my other YouTube channel, Game Grumps.
Oh, that's awesome,
But before I forget, do you know McCluskey or Future of the Left?
No.
I think you would like them.
Okay, cool.
Future
love this.
Of the Left is very punky. I think they're Welsh. Mm-hmm. As far as I know, they're mostly the same band, except Future of the Left has a little bit of synth stuff in it.
Sure.
Very like hard. It's almost like Rage Against the Machine style, but...
But like more synthy.
Yeah, a little more
synthy. I like
synthy.
That.
Yeah, I think you'd like it.
Do you guys have a theremin?
We use that sound occasionally, but we don't actually have a theremin.
I tried to learn to play theremin. I got really into it for a while. It is so fucking hard to play.
Did you have the dial one? You know, you can get the one where it's sort of like a cheater theremin.
No,
it's like
I
a
didn't
valve trombone.
That.
So you have one where it has a little dial or a little slide where it actually tells you what the notes
That's
are.
That's genius. No, yeah. I just had like the standard Moog with the one antenna here and the loop antenna.
Yeah.
And then
That's
I would
the
watch
the real theremin.
The real one. Yeah. And then I would watch videos of there's this one theremin player that
Clara
you can,
Rockmore?
No, it's a guy.
Oh, okay.
But I remember her. But
yeah,
she was
she's
old
the
school.
Original.
It was like black and white, all of hers. But then there's a guy that Moog actually ended up hiring and taking on the road to help promote because he's so phenomenal. And he does like the theme from Amelie.
Oh,
and he does like Crazy by Gnarls Barkley. And it's phenomenal.
It's amazing. Watch it. These like subtle shifts in hand position, right? And the
it's genius. Yeah. See, incredible. I would think that you'd be super into theremin because you're a physicist.
Yeah, I love theremins. I just
it's
don't
impossible
have
impossible
like,
to play.
You need like perfect pitch to really do it, right?
Yeah, you do have to have an incredible ear, and you also have to be really still. Like yes. Your arms must get super sore because it's like you know the hand that does the volume probably a little easier because you're just phrasing.
Yeah, yeah.
But the volume's on the loop, isn't it? No, the loop is the pitch.
Loop's
and then
the pitch,
yeah.
Yeah,
the volume's on the long antenna. But for the pitch, it's literally the fingerings are insane. Right? I think so. Or maybe
I think it's the other way around. Actually, I think the loop is the volume.
You're right. And the long antenna because it's longer and you can do more. But the fingerings are insane. They're like barely moving and it goes and it's oh my God.
It's
but
the
theremins are fun to build.
Yes. Yeah,
there's
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
I had a theremin once that was like a little baby head and its eyes glowed red and it was super creepy and you could
have you seen the documentary, the theremin documentary?
No, is it good?
I mean, I saw it probably like close to 20 years ago, but I remember it just being amazing. Like theremin had all these crazy other instruments that he built.
Really?
One of which I remember was like a room, which was like a giant theremin. So you'd move around the room and
why is that not like at the Exploratorium?
I know, right? So it's something
we
he
need
built
to build
in, like, in like the 30s or something too. Right.
What if it was like a room theremin, but also a Tesla coil? That
yes,
would be
please.
Like my heaven, I think.
I'm into it.
Yeah. Okay, so Ninja Sex Party, super cool synth pop. But you said the other group.
Yeah, is called.
Or the other YouTube channel.
Yep, is Game Grumps, and it's a gaming channel. And so there, with Game Grumps, there are two main guys that are on Game Grumps that put out two episodes a day where they just play a game and kind of talk.
And one of them is not you.
Neither of them is me.
Do you produce the channel?
So what I do is I'm part of, so one of those guys is my partner in Ninja Sex Party.
Dan.
Mm-hmm. The other guy is this guy named Aaron who started the channel. And then I'm part of, I put up other videos on the channel. Mm-hmm. I play, you know, other games and,
gotcha.
And just produce additional content for the channel. And I'm kind of one of the other personalities on the channel.
YouTube loves gaming.
YouTube loves
gaming is by far the most popular.
Huge
to the extent that they had to like change their algorithm so that the homepage isn't always just gaming.
Yeah, it's the biggest YouTube star in the world, PewDiePie, is a gamer. Generally speaking, the bigger YouTube channels that aren't just hashtag channels or genres are all gaming. It's amazing.
Yeah. Oh my God, it's like really loud outside.
Really
I love it.
Now.
It's really coming down.
Gaming. I didn't even realize. And so, you know, I talked to people roughly my age about YouTube gaming, and they're like, "Who wants to watch a bunch of guys playing video games?"
That's how I feel about it, but people do.
People, you know, the way I think about it is, it's like a podcast or it's like a radio show where. At least for Game Grumps, it's not true for every gaming channel. It's not really about the game for us. Mm-hmm. It's about the personalities and the banter. And so.
Well, that's why PewDiePie's so famous. Like, it's because people love him.
Yeah,
exactly. It's not because he's a particularly good gamer. It started because he was like, he would play scary games and then he would get scared. And that was like hilarious to people.
Right. And that's, I mean, people just like the people on the game. There's some gaming channels where it's all about like, okay, we're going to, you know. Give you strategy and that sort of stuff. We do nothing like that. In fact, I think the number one complaint from our fans is that we're terrible at video games.
That's hilarious.
Which is actually true.
And so you do play video games. It's not a tabletop gaming. It's not a whatever. It's a specifically video game. Do you play a certain type?
Everything. I mean, my wheelhouse is retro, is like old school NES.
Oh, that's like the only way I like to
with.
Play.
Yeah, I love it. And we have everything.
I don't
like
controllers
everything.
That have too many buttons. Like, I think that's why I really took to the Wii when it first came out. And I played that a lot because it was really physical. And it was one of those things where it had, the point I think is to make it as intuitive as possible.
Yeah.
Yet, you know, a PlayStation or an Xbox, it's really intuitive to a gamer. But
for
it's not really intuitive to a non-gamer.
Yeah, and to me, I'm just too old. Like, I grew up with the simple NES controller. I mean, even, I think Super Nintendo came out when I was in... maybe late high school.
We didn't have a Super Nintendo. Yeah. We just had an NES. I did have a Game Gear, though. Do you remember Game Gear?
Oh, yeah.
Because it was the first portable color screen. So that was really exciting
for me.
My sister was really into her Game Boy because she's 4 years older than me. And then I had a Game Gear, which I promptly lost. And my parents would never let me have another one. But we played pure NES, Mario 3 all day. All day, every day. Love Dr. Mario.
That was one of the videos we did on Game Grumps.
Awesome.
I used to play Dr. Mario with my sister all the time. We would like, you know, argue over which music. Do you want Fever or Chill?
Yes.
You know, right.
And we even in high school, I used to be like a total burnout pothead, and we would hang out at my friend Jesse's house, and he had a shitty little like cathode ray tube TV with like an old school NES, and like the only game that wasn't completely busted was Dr. Mario, and we would play that nonstop.
And you know what? It still holds up. I mean, I played it like less than a year ago. That's still true. Fucking awesome.
Because I had it on my Wii, like, because you could get all the classic games. And I would play that. And the cool thing about Wii was that you could connect to like remotely to people. And my mom was a huge Tetris nerd when we were growing up. And so we could play Tetris she was back in Texas.
That's so great.
Which was really fun. Yeah.
Do you have a DS, a 3DS?
Mm-mm. Should I get one?
Yeah. Like the Mario World 3D is really, really,
really
great. Yeah. It's really fun.
Oh, cool. And then you can probably still get some of the sort of like arcade style games on it, right?
For sure. Okay, and cool. You can get, I think they did released a bunch of the Zelda games for DS as well.
Oh, Zelda really fun. Was fun.
The other thing I was really into more than Nintendo in like high school was PC adventure games.
Sure.
You know, like all the Sierra games, King's Quest, Police Quest.
I didn't play any of those.
Those were my favorite.
I played puzzles, what was it called? Like Centipede?
Yep.
Yeah. No, it wasn't even Centipede. It was like Worm.
I don't even remember.
It was just a thing going around and eating.
Oh,
back on the PC, like forever ago. It was in all of our classrooms. It was but that was like the era of Oregon Trail.
Uh-huh.
Really early. But I definitely, yes. Did you ever play Simon's Quest?
No,
I loved Simon's Quest. And also we played the Spy versus Spy game a lot.
I've never played it.
That was a go-to. Yeah. And Boy in His Bubble.
Yes, I remember Boy in His Bubble.
That was fun. Oh, and Paperboy.
Paperboy. Yeah, Paperboy was great.
So fun. Okay.
Yeah. We can do this all
the time. I know. So you've got gaming and you've got comedy music.
Yep.
And those two things are probably kind of like your, I don't know, is that like your bread and butter? Would you call that your day job?
Yep, that's my day job.
That's your day
basically
job.
I am an employee of Game Grumps. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, what I do. I play games on the channel, also run all the social media for that channel. And then that takes up, you know, half of any given day. And the rest of the day is Ninja Sex Party, writing, recording, doing business stuff.
Do you like to play tabletop games?
I do. I don't play it that much.
I want to start doing that more. I feel like we should do board game like events or groups.
That'd be great.
Get people together.
Super popular.
It's
right
so
now.
Fun. And I got
there's so many great games.
I didn't really know much about it. And then Will Wheaton actually had me on tabletop a few years ago.
Oh, yeah.
And it was a crazy experience because I know nothing about it. And the way that he usually does tabletop is he puts people at different, like at the same level together. So he has like the novices do an episode and he was like, "You don't know anything about gaming, but you're super smart. So I'm going to put you in with me and with fucking Rich Sumner, you know, the guy from, who's like a madman, who's like a huge gamer,
has his
own channel.
Yeah, yeah.
And then this girl, Jen, I can't remember her last name. She's a Canadian game designer.
Wow.
And the four of us sat down and I was freaked out. And then I fucking won. It was so cool. Really, really fun to do. And that like sparked my interest. He used to have these events. He and Felicia Day for Geek and Sundry would have these events here in LA for Tabletop Day.
Oh, yeah.
And they'd invite all these people and you'd play games all day and then you'd go home with a bunch of board games. And it was so fun. And I even have a bunch of them in my closet and I'm like, we should play games.
And there's so many good ones too. I think there's a real renaissance in tabletop gaming that's been going on for many years now where the games are, I mean, the design is great. The gameplay is interesting.
I have like three versions of Catan and I don't know how to play it. Right. So like, I feel like I should sit down and do that.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's also what I found fun too, is even if you can't do that a lot, or maybe not a lot, a bunch of those have been adapted for mobile gaming.
Oh,
like
cool.
Small World. If you ever play Small World, which is a really fun strategy game, there's a, you know, an iPhone, iPad app that you can play on mobile too, which, okay, it's not quite the same.
No, but that's cool.
It's still
that's cool.
Sort of the same. Same idea.
Yeah, I'm definitely less of a video game player and I'm more of a poker player. That's like my go-to game. I think it's really, really fun and I haven't been playing lately, but I would love to get more.
Never really played.
Oh, you might really love it because it's like mathy, but it's also like gut instinct and there's psychology and I don't know, poker's. And also, I think it's like more of a quote-unquote acceptable game for grown-ups to play. Mm-hmm. So it's more likely that you'll find people who are like willing to come to a poker night than like a tabletop game
sense,
night.
Right.
And people can drink while they're playing poker, which is great because then you can take advantage of them. So I love it. But okay, so there's that. But we haven't talked about Story Collider.
Yeah, Story Collider.
Story Collider. It's Liz Neely and no.
So Story Collider, there are a bunch of people that are on the team. So okay. I'll just give you the history real quick. So I started Story Collider with another guy named Ben Lilly in 2010.
Ben, of course.
Yeah. You know Ben.
Liz
yeah.
didn't start with Ben.
Liz just started at Story Collider like a year ago.
I know Ben from Science Online days.
Oh, yeah, right.
Years
that's
ago.
Why I forgot you guys know each other. Yeah, that's right.
It's so crazy.
So Ben
okay.
and I started. Ben was a theoretical particle physicist, mm-hmm. but had left academia and was living in New York. And we ended up having the same. We were both taking storytelling at UCB in New York, not in the same class, but we had the same teacher. And then, you know, I found out that there was another theoretical physicist
yeah,
doing storytelling.
Yeah, which is
probably
pretty rare at like Upright Citizens Brigade. Yeah,
so
right?
the story that I always tell about this is. So the first day of class, this teacher's name is Margot Lightman, who's just actually out here in LA now and a really, really fantastic storyteller, has a few books, cannot recommend her highly enough, has us all go around the room, and it's like, you know, 10 or 12 people, and say something, you know, introduce yourself and say some unusual thing about yourself. It's mm-hmm. not going to be true of anyone else in the class. And I was like, well, I got this unlocked because I'm a theoretical particle physicist. And so I say that, and I said, that's my unusual thing. And she's like, oh, yeah, I know another guy that does that. And he's a storyteller, too.
Yeah, like my class before you.
Yeah.
I already met one.
And
come up with something new.
she said, it's Ben, and I knew Ben's name from papers. Like, I'd seen his name on papers.
Isn't that so funny?
And so I reached out, and we basically did a story date. We went to a storytelling show and then started Story Collider.
Oh, you did a story date. Yeah. That's so sweet.
And so we were like, we should do this, but for science. And started a show, and that was, you know, I guess coming up on 7 years ago.
Holy shit. So did it start as a show or a podcast or both?
It started, I'm going to get this slightly wrong, but I think podcasting was just such an obvious thing to do. The first thing we do was a live show, but then it was so obvious once we had the recording to take stories from that and do it in a podcast.
So it was pretty soon after or even in conjunction
I think it was at the
it.
Same time. Yeah. I mean, I might maybe, I'm 100% sure we had stories from that first show on a podcast. And Ben actually was the... Ben handled all of the podcasting stuff. He mm-hmm. either figured it out or knew how to do it or something like
Is
that.
Is Ben still doing Story Collider?
Mm-hmm. So oh, Ben cool. we now Ben was the artistic director for a while. Because basically what happens is we started it, and then I was an academic, so I wasn't even staying in New York. I was like moving around to mm-hmm. the next position. And so even though he and I did basically the first year of shows together, I soon had to leave for my job.
Yeah.
And we brought... another person in named Aaron Barker, who's this fantastically talented storyteller, as our co-New York producer. Ben stayed as artistic director. And Ben now Aaron is the artistic director, and Ben kind of does like special projects and, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. I forget what his precise title is.
And they're both in New York.
They're both in New York. I mean, Ben still hosts Story Collider there and produces the shows, but is no longer the artistic director. Because he wanted to focus on some other stuff that he is doing. And now Aaron is the artistic director. And Liz, who you're talking about, Liz Neely, mm-hmm. Is our executive director. We're a nonprofit. And Liz joined us, I mean, it's coming up on a couple of years now.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
And I think she was a Science Online person, too. I feel like
I know she was at Compass for a long time. Okay. And she's just done everything and is generally the best.
Awesome.
Yeah.
I love that. And so mostly you guys are kind of... out of New York, and you do it much more regularly in New York, but you've done London shows. You're starting to do LA shows now.
That's right. So we have regular shows right now going in New York, Boston, DC.
Oh, wow.
We do them frequently in Atlanta.
And so do you have satellite producers in those mm-hmm. places? Okay.
Yep.
That's
so
a
we
smart
have,
way to do it.
Boston producers, DC producers mm-hmm. out here. I co-produced the LA show with Cassie, who I think you met at SciComm Camp.
Yeah. Because she was co-hosting with you.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'm going to be doing a Story Collider.
That's
soon,
right.
I'm so nervous about.
You're going to be awesome.
It's weird because I go up on stage all the time, but like I don't tell stories. And this, guys, what you might not understand is this is like a process. They don't just let somebody be like, I want to tell a story and stand up and tell a story. They have to come up with it. They go back and forth. They help them craft it until it really is a story that we know people want to hear, you know, and it's got a beginning and a middle and an end, and it's interesting and it captures the audience in such a way that you guys are proud to host it on the podcast.
Right. That's right.
And that scares the shit out of me because I have never taken a class at UCB, and I'm actually...
You're going to be a natural at it. I'm 100% sure.
So you've met my friend Tegan. Tegan's been on the podcast a couple of times. Tegan and I are going to take some improv classes together just
to
improve our on-air work, I can't believe
it
I haven't
hurts,
done it
right?
yet.
It's fun and it's...
It never hurts except... that I'm going to shit my pants. Like, it's like, honestly, my biggest fear in the world is to get up and just be goofy in front of people I don't know.
Yeah.
It's so scary.
But the thing about improv, at least one of the things I've done a bunch, and my wife is a very accomplished and wonderful improviser.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, she's hilarious. And she teaches a lot too. One of the early things you learn in improv is you never try to be funny.
Yeah.
Right. You lose the battle when you try to be funny. You just be yourself and react. I mean, you know, it's the acting is reacting kind of thing.
Yeah.
You just do what comes naturally. And then if you're yourself, you're fine.
But then everyone's watching.
Yeah, it's pretty intimidating. I don't do any of it anymore. And I never really performed regularly as an improviser.
Oh, I'm never going to perform. No, I'm only going to take classes.
Even just doing a show here and there is like, it's scary
as
shit. Yeah,
and for me, just like getting up and telling a story is going to be scary. Like, I feel really lucky. And I think that's kind of what's so amazing about Story Colliders. There's a lot of support and there's a lot of help. So you really aren't on your own.
Yeah,
you know,
you get
to feel like you have sort of a collective behind you. Yeah. I'm actually meeting with Allie Ward, who's been on the show before for tea after we get off air. And awesome. She's going to help me with the story.
Perfect.
I was going to have written a draft already, but she was like, don't write it yet. I want to talk to you before you write it. It's like, okay.
Well, at least for us, one of the things, so we try very explicitly to get a lot of scientists on the show. Mm-hmm. And most scientists have like no experience, you know, even holding a microphone.
That's
right?
True. Oh, yeah. I've interviewed so many scientists that need help.
Yeah. And they don't know to talk into the microphone or that sort of thing. So we very early on, we just made the decision. This is always going to be a curated show. And part of the deal is if you want to tell a story, we have to work with you on it. It's also because we have a point of view and a kind of, you know, we don't want it to be lecture-y. That's one of the things that's really important to us is it's about the emotional side and personal side of stuff, not about, you know, a detailed discussion of quarks or, you know, whatever it is.
Yeah. Like, let me tell you about my science. It's like, no.
And that's what every scientist wants to do. Their natural instinct, just because that's what you're trained to do, is to give detailed discussions of minutia about science.
And not just that, but to separate themselves as the actor out of it.
Yes.
Like, it doesn't matter how I felt about that. That's not scientific. It's like, no, but that's all we care about.
That's right. And that's our number one note to every storyteller, especially those coming from a science background, is, but how did you feel? Because you probably wouldn't be surprised the number of first drafts we get, which are, this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened, then this happened.
Oh, no.
It's just like a list of stuff.
It's almost not even first person. It's like third person.
Exactly. And then you're like, yes, but were you upset? Were you, you know, happy?
What is this emotion you speak of?
And a lot of them do say, you know, I just wrote this without even thinking about that because it's how you're trained as a scientist.
So that's funny.
I think what sets us apart from other, you know, science podcasts or things like that is that it is really explicitly focused on that personal narrative. I think it's also important now too, you know, if we want to communicate science to the public, we all know that people don't respond to facts, right? People respond to stories.
Absolutely.
And the personal side and the emotional side. You have to appeal to people's emotions if
and
you want
to. There have to be characters.
Yeah, exactly.
Like nobody gives a shit about anything if it's not character driven. Think of every movie that, you know, possessed you. Think of every book. Think of every podcast that you listen to. They were all character driven. Mm-hmm. Even if it's not a human character, it has to be a character. And that's like the scariest thing in the world to scientists is to personify things.
For sure.
They're like, that's detrimental.
It's really hard. It's why it's hard to get people to care about climate change, right? Because Earth is not a character, right?
Yeah.
What you care about are the people being affected by
exactly.
it.
Exactly. That's true. That's the only time you really think about it is when you think about the people
in those
areas.
And so far, you know, the examples are getting more and more, but there are relatively few examples
and they're
of people.
And those people are so far away and so different.
They're very, you know, typically very underprivileged communities, right? Very poor, a lot of non-white communities. Mm-hmm. And
it's hard for people to put themselves in their shoes.
Those stories, you don't hear those stories because the people are not in a position to tell them.
Yeah.
And so that's something.
No, of course. I think it's finding that balance, right? It's like, I don't want to hear about something depressing.
For sure.
It's like there has to be a silver lining or there has to be some funny aspects to it or something warm and fuzzy to it.
Yeah.
It can't just be one note. It's really hard to just sit down and go like, I'm gonna, especially for a film, like a documentary. I do it all the time, but I'm like a glutton for punishment. But a lot of people are like, I don't want to sit down for 2 hours and just be depressed.
Right.
Ugh. And so that's another cool thing about Story Collider is that like it really runs the gamut. There's like the funny-ish kind of stories. There's the warm, emotional stories. There's the really, really sad stories. But they all kind of are so human.
Yeah. And I think as soon as you focus on a human character, I mean, no one story generally isn't, it's not all depressing.
Yeah.
You know, it's not all happy. It has ups and downs and different emotions. All humans, it's mm-hmm. not just one emotion all the time. So every story has a little bit of everything. And they, you know, sometimes lean, like you said, on balance more one way or the other. But if you just listen to people talk and what they're actually feeling, it's going to move around anyway.
So I have to ask you if you have the same experience before we'll finish up after that. But I give talks a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I podcast a lot. I'm in front of big crowds and it never freaks me out when I'm talking. It will to tell a story, I think. But like when I'm just giving a speech or whatever, that's easy. I used to be a singer. I like you, went to college for music first, mm-hmm. and then I moved over.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, I was a jazz vocalist. And I went to the University of North Texas, which is a really big jazz school.
Yeah, for sure.
And so I sang all through I started in elementary school, but I sang professionally kind of through high school and into college.
Oh, wow,
like,
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And I don't really anymore. As a smoker for a long time, I stopped taking voice and stuff. I might get back into it just to help with my on-camera work. That said, as easy it is for me to get in front of a crowd of thousands of people and give a talk, every time I got up to sing, like that 10 seconds before I started and about 30 seconds into the song, I always felt like I was going to shit my pants. Do you get that when you perform music?
Not really.
Really?
No. And it's
how do you get past it? Is it just doing it a lot, or is that something I'm always going to struggle with?
I don't know. Maybe it is just doing it a lot. For me also, I mean, I've never really had stage fright for performing, and
like it's even stage fright. I don't know how to explain
whatever,
it.
Whatever, nervousness. For me, I'm also in a special position, at mm-hmm. least with Ninja Sex Party, and storytelling too, because unlike, let's say, classical mm-hmm. music, you don't need to be perfect. And so with Ninja Sex Party, I mean, we've played, our biggest crowd recently was we sold out the Aragon in Chicago, which is about 5,000 people, which is just amazing. But
that's amazing.
I'm dressed up in a ninja costume and like everything, if you screw something up, it's a joke. It's funny. And so, you know, we try to get the music as good as possible.
Of course.
And we Twerp, our backing band, super, super talented musicians. But if something really goes wrong, we can make a joke out of it because it's ultimately a comedy show more than a music show. And with storytelling, if something goes wrong, well, it's just kind of humanizing, right?
But also nobody else knows. I did learn that. That was a thing that I learned early on with choreography, right? Like, I'm not a great dancer, but it was always pounded into my head. Like, it's not a mistake if no one can tell you made it.
Right.
Like, if you just roll off, if you don't stop and look freaked out like a deer in headlights, but you just turn it into whatever, like, nobody knows you weren't supposed to do that.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So that's really helpful. I think you're right. As you're saying that, I'm realizing, like, most of the time when I was performing as a musician, I was performing with a group, and then I might solo, and that would be really nerve-wracking for me.
Yeah.
And I would have a coach who's watching
and
who's trained us. And it's like, you know, do the thing we've been practicing over and over and over. And it's like, I don't want to let anybody down.
Yeah, exactly.
But if it were just me on my own accord making the decision, maybe I wouldn't feel like I was going to shit
my pants. And for Ninja Sex Party, you know, I and Dan wrote all the songs we're performing.
Yeah.
So it's not like it's someone else's material you're screwing up.
Who's Same sitting there going like, don't fuck it up, don't fuck it up.
Right. I mean, storytelling, you're telling your own story. And at least this happens all the time. You just go back, you know, if you forget something that's crucial, you say, oh, I forgot to say.
Yeah.
And then you just say it and no one cares.
I know I'm going to do that a lot. And I see people do that during storytelling and I appreciate it, especially when because this is just kind of my personality, when you'd be like, oh, I almost forgot the most important part.
Yeah.
It just like pulls you in.
For sure.
You know, it's you're right. It's humanizing.
Yeah.
It's the same reason I don't really edit the podcast. It's
right.
just, I don't, it's, maybe people don't want to hear me. Like, I think you could hear the sound of me drinking tea earlier. I didn't realize I was so close to the mic. Maybe that's kind of gross.
Yeah, I was coughing.
But,
like,
but it's like, really, we're people.
Yeah.
All right. Well, Brian, I always end the show with the same two questions.
Cool.
And I'm going to ask you the same two. When you think about the future, and this could be contextually bound however you want. So it could be like your own personal future. It could be kind of the future of the globe, the future of your community, whatever mm-hmm. the fuck. The first thing is, what is the thing that like is most disconcerting to you? What keeps you up the most at night? Like, what are you worried about? But on the flip side of that, what are you really optimistic and hopeful and excited about?
Worried about, probably a million people have said this, it's climate change.
Yeah.
I mean, yep, it's always the answer. what else are you going to say?
But really, it's the fucking most important one.
Yeah, I mean, it is an existential threat, right? Any way you look at it. So what am I worried about? That. And it's nothing we can control individually. We can contribute, but can't control it.
And it's, yeah, it's the political shit. Yeah, there's so much to say about it. And it's like, it's a bummer. I kind of hate ending with these two questions because the first one makes me super depressed. So
yeah,
I'm kind of glad you're like, climate change, moving on.
Yeah. But what fills me with hope is, or what I'm excited about is it really, this is something that comes from YouTube, mm-hmm. which is watching communities be activated and engaged and supportive. And I know a lot of what you hear online, you know, or people like trolls and really horrible shit going on.
Especially with YouTube.
Yeah. But what I think you hear less of, and what I see whenever we meet fans or do shows or storytelling or whatever, is you see people supporting each other and mm-hmm. really becoming part of a real actual community, not, you know, like a fake, you know, hypothetical one, but a real community of people who are mm-hmm. looking out for each other and supporting each other. And one thing I'm very hopeful for the future is, especially, you know, whether you want to talk about politically, you know, progressivism kind of being activated by all the stuff that's going on now, or even, you know, just otherwise marginalized groups of people, them coming together to be a supportive force for one another.
Absolutely. You know, there really is something to be said about the fact that we have this tool to connect us. So now, if you were living in a smaller town or a community where you were maybe like a little shy or nervous to try and find, or it's just not your way to go out and try to meet people, and you have such specific interests and goals, you can find people that are so similar to you, that are so like-minded, which mm-hmm. is kind of what it means to find your people, right? To find your group. And it used to be really hard to do that. And now so easy. And the sad part is you may not be able to see each other in the flesh as often as you'd like, but because there are, you know, you've got these YouTube channels that unify people, and then a lot of times they are kind of genre specific. Mm-hmm. So then there's like a con that you can go
to. Well, exactly. That's what I was going to say, is there are opportunities at cons, mm-hmm. at shows. So when we do the Major Sex Party shows or the Game Grumps shows, which I actually don't do the Game Grumps stuff, but I've been to a bunch of mm-hmm. them, seeing people come together and say, oh, I finally, this is my group, and I'm finally in the same place.
Yeah, and they're like, oh my God, you're RJ279. They're dude, I was just responding to you.
Right,
like,
exactly.
It's super cool.
Yeah, so I think there's, I mean, it's, to me, I've seen it just a bunch of times over the past year. It is, it's just, it's a wonderful feeling to see people coming together and, you know, and just being a part of something big.
I love that. Well, Brian, thank you so much for coming on
the
show.
Thank you, Kara. This is super fun.
Super fun. Before you go, let everybody know like where they can find you on Twitter or Facebook or, you know, your YouTube pages, like how they can reach out.
Yeah. So on Twitter, you can find me, my personal account at Bewecht, B-W-E-C-H-T. I think I spelled that correctly. and then the two channels are Ninja Sex Party, which is musical comedy, all social media, stuff like that. It's all Ninja Sex Party, so you can find us there. And Game Grumps, same thing, YouTube, all the various socials. And I think I'm Bewecht on Instagram and maybe a couple other things as well.
Are you a big Instagrammer?
I do a bunch of it. It's
you do.
Mainly, the social media platform I like the most is Twitter.
Me too, by far.
But Instagram, I like Instagram a lot too.
I'm trying to get better at it. It's mostly pictures of my dog.
Yeah, I do a bunch of those.
Yeah.
For me, it's a lot of pictures of my daughter because she is you know, 2.5 and just at the
adorable.
Cutest possible age right now. Yeah, for Game Grumps, we do a lot of Instagram.
Awesome. And very, very cool. Well, again, thank you so much for joining me. Super fun. And for having a nice spot of tea.
Yeah, thank you.
It was great. And everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.